Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Hello and welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm your guest host for today, Kyle Scheindler, filling in for the great Frank Gaffney, who is off tonight. And to get started, I'd like to talk about this really amazing news that has broken regarding the possibility of a Trump-Kim Jong-un summit to discuss North Korean nuclear weapons. And there is no one better to talk about that with than the great Gordon Chang. He is author of The Coming Collapse of China and The Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, two excellent works in the Asia field. Gordon, thanks for joining us. We're glad that you're here to help us out.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Kyle.
So first of all, can you walk us through sort of how this news broke and how the decision was made? Because it was a little bit strange.
It certainly was. The decision was announced Thursday evening by the South Korean delegation, which included Chung Yi-yong, who is the National Security Advisor. It was made after Chung met with President Trump, and President Trump on the spot accepted an invitation conveyed by Chung to meet. Chung had met Kim Jong-un earlier in the week in Pyongyang, and this is certainly a stunning development, not only because of the tension between the United States and South Korea, but because there was so little preparation for this. This was President Trump impulsively making a decision, but I think it was the correct decision. And the reason why it's correct, regardless, you know, I don't trust the North Koreans, nobody does, but obviously President Moon Jae-in of South Korea wanted this summit to occur between Trump and Kim. And the most important thing for the United States at this moment is to make sure that the alliance with South Korea remains strong, because the overriding reality is that the United States and South Korea together are much more powerful than the countries on the other side, North Korea and China. And as long as we stay together, we will always have acceptable outcomes and maybe even good ones. But the important point here is to maintain the alliance.
I think that's a really good point, Gordon, and it goes to my next question, which is that a lot hinges on the willingness of Kim to give up his program or to denuclearize, and that is supposedly the claim that the South Koreans delivered, that Kim had put this on the table. But the only source we really have for that is the South Koreans themselves, and we know that the South Koreans desperately want to have this conversation. Is there a possibility that the South Koreans are setting Donald Trump up, and that when he gets to the table, it's going to be a very different conversation than what he was promised?
Yeah, the South Koreans could certainly be blowing smoke. President Moon has an incentive, a political one, to exaggerate Kim Jong-un's willingness. But the news that we got from Chung was that Kim had committed himself to denuclearization. That meets a key U.S. demand. I don't think, nobody thinks that Kim really believes that. But in a certain sense, it almost doesn't matter, because President Trump is doing the right thing, and that is not reducing sanctions pressure in anticipation of this meeting. We need to keep the sanctions on, because the most important thing right now is to cut off money flows to North Korea. And because of that, I think that we are seeing some signs that the regime is running out of money. South Koreans are saying that the North will run out of foreign currency reserves by October. Also, the Chinese are saying that office number 39, which is the Kim family slush fund, is really low on cash as well. So, you know, you have a very interesting situation where the Kims need to talk to the rest of the world to get sanctions relief, President Trump needs to make sure the rest of the world doesn't give him money.
Of course, we've seen with other situations, and I'm thinking here specifically of the Iran deal, where all the talk was that the Iranians were also very badly hurting under sanctions, and therefore they needed some way to have sanctions lifted, only to have what turned out to be, of course, a completely disastrous deal. How does Donald Trump make sure that he doesn't have a repeat of the Iran deal?
Well, I think the Iran deal, the problem was that you had an American president who desperately wanted an agreement and who was willing to push the Europeans in that direction. I don't think that President Trump is desperate for a deal. And we have the sanctions on. We have a lot of friends. You know, it's just a question of the president. I mean, what's his instinct? What's his how good of a negotiator is he? You know, the North Koreans are terribly good negotiators. They've obviously planned this out for quite some time, but they haven't met somebody like Donald Trump. I think that the North Koreans, assuming the South Koreans say is true, I think that Kim Jong-un wanted to drive a wedge between Seoul and Washington. Trump's instinct on the spot was not to let that happen. That's really good. You know, we have had in past administrations, Republicans and Democrats, he had months, years of interagency discussions, studies, reports, deliberations, and the outcome of all that was really bad policy. You know, Donald Trump takes 45 minutes, according to the New York Times, and comes out with the right decision. So I have some confidence that the president will not make at least major mistakes going forward.
Well, I think that's a really good point, Gordon Chang. And also, it was part of the establishment reaction to this event was to howl in horror to say, you know, we saw Wendy Sherman, for example, who knows a thing or two about failed negotiations with North Korea, say, you know, you can't go into these negotiations without this kind of preparation and so on and so forth. So they really reacted very negatively to the instinctual Trump response. But as you point out, you know, Trump is a longtime businessman and he's gone with his gut before and won. So as he walks into these negotiations with the Kims, is there sort of a maximal position we should expect? Should Donald Trump go for broke? And what is the red line? What are the red lines?
Yeah, the initial preparation item is that the United States should increase sanctions on North Korea during these talks to give the North Koreans an incentive to actually do the right thing. Our position should be not only the complete abandonment of their nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs, but also it's got to be verifiable. We've got to have anytime, anywhere inspections so that we can make sure that the North Koreans will honor the deal. North Koreans will never honor a deal. You have to make sure that they have no choice but to do the right thing, and that is involved having a lot of people running around North Korea, looking in every building and under every leaf to make sure there are no hidden facilities.
And we have every reason to believe that those hidden facilities already exist, right? So we're looking for hidden facilities we know are already there.
Well, yes. And to just give you a stark example, in Yongbin, which is their nuclear city, we knew, of course, about their plutonium reactor and their only plutonium-producing reactor. We didn't know until the North Koreans showed us that right next door they had a facility to enrich uranium. This completely took us by surprise. And remember, this is in one of the most heavily inspected areas on Earth. So you imagine the rest of North Korea, you know, who knows what where they are, but we can be pretty sure that they're enriching uranium in a number of other locations that have not been disclosed.
And of course, if we're talking about having large numbers of inspectors and intelligence people in North Korea keeping their eyes out for all these possibilities of the Kim family cheating at nuclear denuclearization, that's obviously going to rub the Chinese the wrong way, correct? How are they likely to respond?
Well, to a certain extent, I don't care how they respond. The U.S. has overwhelming leverage over China. What we have not had in past administrations is the willingness to use that power to achieve important ends, including protecting the American people. So if Beijing gets upset, you know, that seems to me to be not a big deal for us.
This is a real positive. It sounds like Donald Trump will be walking into these negotiations with a strong hand to play.
Yes, well, he certainly has a strong hand to play. Now, we know that American presidents have made every mistake in the book when it comes to North Korea. But I generally trust the president's instincts. And remember, you know, if for some reason he decides he wants a bad deal, we're going to have a lot of people, including you and Frank Gaffney, make sure that there's enough pressure that he doesn't do this.
And we will certainly be here to do that. Gordon Chang, thank you so much for your time. We will be right back here on Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm your guest host, Kyle Scheidler of the Center for Security Policy. I am filling into the big shoes of my boss, Frank Gaffney, who is off tonight. Joining me now is Kevin Freeman. He's a colleague at the Center for Security Policy, where he's a senior fellow studying and really one of the few people who has mastered the art of economic warfare. And I wanted to talk to you, Kevin, a little bit about this situation with tariffs. We know that President Trump has proposed and is moving forward with steel and aluminum tariffs. And first of all, could you tell us a little bit about how that would work as we understand it right now and what some of the likely impacts will be?
Yeah, Kyle, it's good talking with you. President Trump pointed out in tweets, and that's the way he begins his efforts, political efforts, is they generally begin with tweet. And he talked about unfair trade practices, and the reality of it is he's observed something that's very true and very real. The Chinese have massive overcapacity in steel and aluminum. They've been producing enormous amounts of the stuff, and they've been shipping it around the world and using other countries to get their excessive production into the United States and other places. And President Trump said, we're going to look to put tariffs on this. And he did, as President Trump often does. He kicks you in the teeth, and then he begins the negotiation, so that you say, "Oh no, you can't." You know, and good people like Larry Kudlow noticed this and said, has he gone away from the idea of free trade? Are we going into a trade war and so forth?" And got quite concerned about it. And the president actually tweeted back, "You know, trade wars are easy, and we can win them," kind of thing. Which scared all of the free traders everywhere, and they all came back and said, well, if he would target China, then it would be okay. Now, if President Trump had started off by saying we're going to target China, all the free traders would be arguing with him, oh, you can't do that. But instead, he said, we're going to do this. He kicked everybody in the teeth, and they said, oh, my goodness. And now everybody's back on the idea that maybe China does deserve to have some tariffs placed on these particular industries, and maybe we should be looking even further.
I'm talking with Kevin Freeman. He's the founder of globaleconomicwarfare.com, and there's really nobody better to talk to us about the current tariff situation that President Trump has announced. You were talking about Trump's negotiating position and how he has managed to get the free traders around to the idea that perhaps tariffing China on steel and aluminum wouldn't be the worst thing in the world.
Well, even further, they're admitting the intellectual property theft that China's been conducting against us for decades. And so good people like Larry Kudlow and others who said, well, it wouldn't be so bad. And in fact, you know, I applaud the president. He's pulled it off again. I read that from Kudlow this morning. So actually, I think it's a good strategy, and I think it's an effective strategy. And we need to do something because the trade deficit has been enormous. It puts us at great risk over the long term. And I think he's got a good starting point here.
You know, the Chinese responded to the recent news by saying that they didn't want a trade war, but they would retaliate if the U.S. started one. How would the Chinese retaliate, and are we prepared to defend ourselves to whatever their response will be?
Well, one of the primary claims, there was a piece written, and Frank Gaffney and I talked about it last week on this program, that was in the Quixi magazine, published, I think, around 2011, and they listed a series of things that they would do, targeting us in financial warfare and economic warfare and so forth. One of the most serious ones that was mentioned is that they might begin to dump their holdings of our debt. And they threatened if we attack them economically, they could just ruin us financially.
Is that true? Can they?
Well, they do hold a huge amount of our debt, and we are dependent on ever-increasing amounts of debt because we continue to run deficits. We have almost $21 trillion worth of debt now, and we have to reborrow every year because that debt rolls off and we have to renew it on a continuing basis. And we also have enormous interest payments. So yes, they could damage us severely if they stop buying our debt and if they dumped it on the open market. But that would create new implications. China's not debt-free themselves. They're in pretty bad fiscal position in a lot of ways. And so if they wanted to escalate to that level, yeah, they could, and there'd be retaliations and problems, and it would get worse. I don't think that they'll do that over this trade issue, but they keep threatening it.
You know, Kevin, one of the things I think that is very striking about the conversation we're having on Trump tariffs, especially from the free traders and others, is the idea that, oh, goodness, Trump is going to start an economic war. Trump is going to start a trade war. But the reality, of course, as you've documented repeatedly at globaleconomicwarfare.com and in your books, is that we're already in an economic war. This is something that is constantly ongoing.
That's absolutely right. There's no doubt about it, and it's being acknowledged other places. For example, the Navy and Marine Corps put out a report that said that China is weaponizing capital that was referenced in The Hill on just last week. They're using their financial means that they've acquired through intellectual property theft, through excessive trade, and sometimes unfair trade practices, and through bullying in other cases, and they're using that money to weaponize capital, and we are in an existing current trade war. The fact that the Trump administration acknowledges it is not a problem. It is a path to the solution. You first have to realize the problem that you have before you can deal with it.
If I'm sitting at home looking at my portfolio, what do I do when I hear news that Trump is preparing to respond to this economic warfare that we've faced over a period of, many years now? What's my best option?
Well, one of the first things you could have done is realize that if you read the book, The Art of the Deal, you realize that the way President Trump negotiates is he goes out and takes a very harsh position, and then he will typically back off from it achieve the objective he wants. He knows that if he takes a softer position to begin with, he'll never get to his objective. But if he goes well beyond what his desired objective is, he can back up. So what happened is the stock market sold off immediately. Trade war, worst panic, and so forth. Well, that created an opportunity for those who felt as if the president was going to take a more nuanced approach in the end, and they were able to buy it. I would be focusing on American. I would be pro-America in my investments. I would look for changes that if China were to no longer receive the enormous benefits of us looking the other way, there will be companies that will be impacted from that, and there will be other companies benefited from it.
I think I like the sound of that, that our investments should be pro-American. And how can the average investor do that? Are there options available if they want to say, I want to make sure that where I put my money is a place that's going to, help me financially, but it's also going to help America?
Well, we've been training financial advisors at the National Security Investment Consultant Institute, NSIC.org. And if you have a financial advisor, you should have them look into that, because we do provide information and training along those lines on how to invest more pro-America. And we're starting a television program, Economic War Room, and it'll be under economicwarroom.com, where we'll be putting up information on a regular and ongoing basis about the economic war and how Americans can respond to it.
Well, Kevin, that's all the time we have, but I'm really glad to be able to have you on, because there is no one better to help walk us through this economic battlefield. I would encourage all the listeners to check out globaleconomicwarfare.com. Kevin, thank you so much. This is Secure Freedom Radio, and we will be right back.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm Kyle Scheindler, guest hosting today for Frank Gaffney, who is off. Joining me now, he's the national security reporter at the Washington Times, Rowan Scarborough. And Rowan has been following with a great amount of detail the ongoing hubbub of the Russia dossier investigation and the so-called Trump-Russia collusion investigation. And he's really one of the few people here in Washington who's able to keep all these parts in his head together in the same at the same time. So, Rowan, we're really glad to have you on today.
Hey, I'm glad to be with you.
So I wanted to ask you about a recent article that I saw that you did at the Washington Times regarding a claim by a man named Oleg Deripaska that George Soros was involved in the funding of Fusion GPS. Can you start off by telling us first, who is Oleg Deripaska, and then what was his claim?
He is what has come to be called an oligarch, a very, very rich Russian who at one time had a lot to do with how the country was run, but now is just a basic rich guy who owns a huge investment firm, and he's the second largest producer. His company is the second largest producer of aluminum in the world. So his worth is about $6 or $7 billion, according to Forbes. And he's also involved with American ventures, and most notably that would be with Paul Manafort, who was President Trump's campaign manager for a while and now is under indictment for income tax evasion. And at one time he worked for Mr. Deripaska doing various consulting work in Europe. And that's how Deripaska's name has popped up mostly. But now, with an op-ed that he wrote in the Daily Caller, which appeared last week, all of a sudden he's injected himself into the infamous Christopher Steele dossier, because Mr. Deripaska claims that George Soros, another billionaire, is one of the funders of Fusion GPS, which produced the dossier with money from the Democratic Party. So it's sort of, you know, the dossier story has many, many tentacles. It goes in different directions. But according to Mr. Deripaska, his attorney in Washington, Adam Waldman, testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee and told them that he had had a conversation with a Daniel Jones. And Daniel Jones is a former staffer for Dianne Feinstein, who now has his own investigative firm. And it was Mr. Jones who told Mr. Waldman that Soros has been or now is funding Fusion GPS. Why Deripaska decided to disclose that, whether he's fully accurate, it is going to have to play out. I tried to get a comment from Fusion, and I did not get one. But if it's true, then Fusion GPS is under a lot of pressure because it's being sued for libel in several different courts related to the Steele dossier. And legal fees, as we know, are extremely expensive. So it would be a big boon to Fusion if George Soros is involved. And it shows that another big Democratic player besides Hillary Clinton and the DNC is involved in nourishing Fusion GPS to do its investigative work.
I think that's so curious, Rowan. And I've always had my eye on Mr. Deripaska because he's, A, such kind of an odd figure, and also because he appears sort of on both sides of this Russia collusion argument. Because, as you mentioned, he is tied to Paul Manafort, who was, because of Manafort's former business ties, was one of the leading people in sort of establishing this claim that Trump had ties to Russia. And then on the other hand, Deripaska's lawyer is speaking with Senator Mark Warner, trying to line up some kind of conversation between Warner and Christopher Steele. So he appears almost on sort of both sides of the issue at the same time.
Without a doubt. And why the attorney for Deripaska would have a line to Christopher Steele in London is something that the House Intelligence Committee is now trying to figure out. They have sent letters out to different people, including Deripaska, to explain this link. I mean, it raises the possibility has Christopher Steele have a business relationship with Deripaska? And if so, what is Deripaska investigating his business interests or people opposed to him? Deripaska files lawsuits. You know, he has sued a number of people over business deals. He has sued Paul Manafort several times. Perhaps he has used Christopher Steele as a private investigator. It's unclear. You know, what makes his op-ed credible is that, as you pointed out, Senator Warner has been speaking with Mr. Waldman as a link to Mr. Steele. So that tells you that it's credible that Waldman would have had an interview with the Senate Intelligence Committee or a staff interview. And it would be credible that Mr. Deripaska says that his attorney met with Mr. Jones, who was also out there apparently trying to prove that the dossier is true. This is because, I mean, if his source is his own lawyer, then you would think that would add credence to the fact that this meeting happened. So Mr. Jones, Daniel Jones, is also, I'm told, tied in some way to Fusion GPS, helping each other out on different projects. So it's quite complex, isn't it?
It certainly is. And I think, Rowan, you could tell our audience that typically journalists are supposed to prove something's true before they publish it, not after.
That's right. The cart is supposed to go behind the horse. That's perfectly correct. I don't think BuzzFeed ever thought that it would face so many libel suits. I think it's three right now. Plus, Steele himself is being sued. Steele's filing in the London court, where he's being sued by another rich Russian tech guy, is very revealing, because his dossier is so matter of fact. Extensive conspiracy between Trump and the Kremlin during the campaign. Now, no one has seen real evidence of this conspiracy. It seems to me that by now it would have leaked out if the FBI had found such a thing. But in his filing, Steele only talks of a, quote, possible coordination between the campaign and Russia. So he has come quite a bit back from that declaration. And he has also stressed that I gave these tips to Washington reporters for them to go out and prove. Again, he's a lot less affirmative in this court filing when he's under penalty than he was when he circulated the dossier in the fall of 2016.
Ron, I wanted to ask you quickly, as you mentioned the House committee, and you said, you know, if this was being investigated, we would have heard about it by now. And that's certainly true, because everything that's done on the House Intel Committee leaks. It seems like literally everything. Why is that? And how are some of the House members responding to this situation?
Well, I mean, I counted up over two dozen leaks out of the House committee, Intel committee investigation, that seem very likely to be Democrat, since they're anti-Trump. And I singled out five that have been really wrong or decidedly misleading. And Adam Schiff denies that he's doing this, but it certainly seems like a calculated effort by the Democrats to damage Trump in any way they can, because they have not been able to prove collusion. But so they take tidbits of things that are said and inaccurately leak them, or sometimes they just leak inaccurate information altogether, such as Donald Trump Jr. received emails from WikiLeaks alerting him that their emails were coming in a few days, when in fact that was totally wrong. I mean, he can't control who sends him emails, and the WikiLeaks email came after the dump. not before. So that was a totally untrue story that went to CNN and ran all during the day.
Rowan, we thank you so much for coming on Secure Freedom Radio and helping us keep all of these threads straight. And one thing is clear, and I think you pointed that out, is that we would not see all these leaks if there was any there. We look forward to having you back to talk more about that. We'll be coming back just a moment here on Secure Freedom Radio. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm your guest host, Kyle Scheidler, filling in for the great Frank Gaffney, who is off tonight. Joining me is Peter Husey. He's the Director for Strategic Deterrent Studies at the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies. And we're glad to have you on today with us, Peter. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate coming back.
So I wanted to talk to you about these recent comments by Vladimir Putin regarding the Russian nuclear arsenal. He made some very provocative statements about the capabilities of the Russian arsenal, particularly the capabilities to defeat what missile defense we have. Is he being honest there? Is this a real threat, or is he puffing himself up?
Well, it's both. Some of my friends took some of the pictures and video he had and found that one of them was a 1959 mock-up of an American weapon system that we never built. So why they did that, I don't know. But yes, this is his – he laid out relatively – all the kind of whiz-bang gizmos that are going to get people excited, but he left out all the strategic systems like missiles, submarines, and bombers and cruise missiles that he is also doing in a big way, which was kind of strange. But yes, he announced in 2000 he was going to use nuclear weapons in a conventional conflict preemptively or first. Then in 2006, he says, I'm going to fully modernize our nuclear deterrent. And then in 2014, he said, we're going to be 70% done by the end of the decade. And now he has said, we're going to be 100% modernized by the end of the decade. And yet not once during that period of time did the United States adopt a threat-based nuclear deterrent. This administration did. The NPR completely flipped the tables, as General Hyten says, and we did a threat-based NPR. And the threat, of course, we said is China, Russia, and North Korea to a lesser extent, but that it was based on the real world that these are adversaries. And instead of in 2010, where the administration, previous administration said Russia was going to be cooperative in all sorts of areas, we now know that not only they're not cooperative, but they're, as someone wrote recently, is they are really at war with us. But it's not just kinetic war, it's disinformation. It's economics, it's military, it's across the board. So, yes, this administration has been very, very serious about that. But one caveat, we're on the same calendar everybody else is, and they've been going running around the track, and we haven't even gotten our shoes on yet to run the race. And so we start from being way behind the eight ball, and we don't have, you know, as someone said, we've run out of road. We can't kick the can down the road anymore. We have to do the modernization. And critically important is the theater capability that you could put on a cruise missile, on a surface ship or a submarine, as well as low-yield warhead on the D-5, which is the missile that goes on our boomers, our big submarines. That plus modernizing the land-based system, the bombers, and the submarines, all of which are between, you know, 40, 50, and 60 years old when we do this, are critical. And this administration has been very good. The nuclear posture view is excellent.
You wrote a good article about that recently, Peter, in Family Security Matters, talking about how it was that the Reagan administration sort of squared this circle. And, of course, the challenge is modernization versus sort of dealing with the numbers of weapons. And one of the things that President Trump said when he came in was he wanted more weapons, and he sort of got poo-pooed for that. But is he entirely off base there? What is the right mix of modernity and weapon numbers?
Well, he got it exactly right. What Reagan did was said, look, everybody thinks arms control, the assault process, means you don't build weapons. Said, no, you have to have a modern force. But if you have fewer numbers like the other guy, you can do it in a stabilizing and a balanced way that keeps your security, improves it. Trump comes in and says, I got all these systems that Clark Murdoch, the former guy over at CSIS and then worked for the House of Representatives, said, we're going to rust to obsolescence if we don't replace this stuff. So you don't get a choice of saying, well, we won't redo that. You're going to take that 50-year-old car and give it to my daughter to go drive to college. You wouldn't dare do that. But we're going to do that with our nuclear deterrent. So we have to modernize across the board. We're going to stay within the 1550 number, which is the New START number. But we don't have to down the road. But our problem is the Russians can really break out. We would have a hard time. We could do some. But our ability to produce more warheads as well as breakout is going to be very is tough. We're still behind the eight ball, but the administration has done a good job of laying out where we need to go to get there. If we modernize, we'll be better. But again, the problem is that the weapons that aren't controlled by treaty, meaning the theater systems we call them, there's no control. There's no limit. And the Russians have at least 2,000, and we have about 200. And ours are in Europe, and theirs are primarily aimed at Europe. And that balance is the one that is completely out of whack. And then, of course, the Chinese have no limit whatsoever on any nuclear weapon they build. Or does North Korea, of course. So you have the United States limited on our long-range weapons, but our short ones, we've decided, remember, at the end of the Cold War, Bush 41 and Clinton took all the theater weapons we had and took them off ships, took them from home from Europe. We got rid of thousands of these things and don't have them anymore. So I think they've got the right mix, but the problem is you're starting from way, way behind the eight ball. You've got to modernize everything in sequence. And if you skip a year or slow down, you're going to have systems. Basically, you can't deploy submarines because the hull is too old. Minuteman will become more and more difficult to maintain because of the cost. And bombers will not be able to penetrate air defenses. So you'll do without.
Yeah, I think this is, it's an example where we've reached the point where we can no longer simply go along to get along. It's either modernize or not have the capability at all.
Oh, you're exactly right, 100%.
Isn't that where the Global Zero people wanted us? I mean, didn't they kind of guide us down this path intentionally?
I've been fighting these what I call termites during the Reagan administration. They were the same people, called themselves the nuclear freeze. And they were against everything Reagan did in terms of the modernization of our plans. But then when he even proposed 0-0 on the INF treaty, the missiles in Europe, which the Russians treaty that's the one they're violating, they said, oh, it's a trick because it's unfair to the Russians. And then we said, let's cut in half the nukes we have. And he said, oh, it's a trick. The Russians never agree. And then we said under START 2, let's get rid of multiple warhead land-based missiles, which are 98-99% on alert, and they're the thing that Reagan called the window of vulnerability. Those are very dangerous things because Russia can have 10, 12, 15, 24 warheads on these things, and you can break out very quickly. And we banned them under START 2, but guess what? Clinton never got START 2 approved by the Duma and the Senate in the same form, so it went away. We blew that opportunity. You asked about missile defense. Very important. If we could shoot down 100, 200 warheads, Russia's got thousands. Okay, 1,500 at least on their strategic systems. And if you can shoot down X number, what you do in a crisis is you say the small, limited strike to get our attention, to coerce us to do something, that goes away. And that's what Reagan talked about, limiting the coercive blackmail capability of missiles armed with nuclear weapons. Can't shoot everything down, and you don't have to shoot everything down. Missile defense is designed, I would make it as robust as possible, but you can't shoot down 1,000. But if I could shoot down 100, that gives me real leverage with China, gives me real leverage in North Korea.
I think that's well said, Peter. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have today for Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you for joining us, Peter Husey. He's with the American Foreign Policy Council. We will be back tomorrow, same time, same channel. Thank you very much. For Frank Gaffney, this has been Kyle Scheidler, Secure Freedom Radio.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.